My guest tonight is Anita Diamond. She's a novelist, essayist, journalist, and we're talking about her latest book, Period, End of Sentence, a new chapter in the fight for menstrual justice. Anita, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
What brought you to writing this book? You've written a lot of books, but not about this.
Not about this. Well, it really sort of came to me. I had watched the it was inspired by the movie called Period, End of Sentence.
Oh, you should explain that.
Which won an Academy Award for Best Short Documentary in 2019. And, I was sitting on my couch watching and jumped up when they won. And, amazing. The director said, it's amazing. I can't believe a movie about periods just won an Oscar.
Well, can you talk a little bit about that movie for people who aren't familiar with it?
The movie is it's 20 minutes long, 25 minutes long. You can watch it on Netflix, Period, End of Sentence. It's a short film made actually as a result of a group of high school students in California who learned about period poverty, especially in India, and they learned about the existence of these small, portable period pad-making machines that were being donated to communities in rural India. And this high school actually had a relationship with one of these villages, and they decided, okay, we're going to raise money, and we're going to buy a machine for this community. This is a high school in Hollywood, California, and they thought, we should make a documentary about this so that we can spread the word. And they indeed did. They raised money. They did a Kickstarter campaign, the whole thing, and hired a very young director out of film school, and voila, they won an Academy Award. And because of the publicity from the movie, they got inundated with emails and phone calls and requests for help and offers to donate and personal stories about period inequities. And, so they were off and running, and they were looking to do a book that was connected to the movie, and found my agent. My agent called me and said, would you be interested? And I didn't have a project at the time, and I had actually written about this a little bit as a journalist. So I said, yeah, I'd love to talk to them. And the rest is history. So we started. There was talk about traveling and doing first-person reporting, but then we had COVID.
Right. So
this is a book that I wrote during the lockdown, pretty much. But the internet is wonderful, and I did lots of research, and I talked to people also on the phone about this topic, learned a lot, didn't know much about this when I started, and so that's the story of the book.
And it covers a lot of things that we're going to touch on as we talk about later. You also wrote a novel called Red Tent.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did that resonate with people in a certain way, too?
Yes. And I think the filmmakers had made the connection in their head. The Red Tent is a novel set in a biblical story, and the story of the wives of Jacob and his only daughter, Dinah. And in my fictional imagining of that time and place, women were sequestered in a tent when they had their periods, also when they were giving birth and when they were ill. And there are, in fact, I knew that there had been tents and huts like this around the world. And I imagined it as a place of respite and community rather than punishment, which is the way it has largely been viewed. So the novel talks about, it really tells a biblical story from the point of view of the women. And the tent is this place, this sort of has become an iconic image. And I think my name is, for people who've read the novel, identified with this notion of the menstrual tent. Although the book doesn't all take place in this tent.
Now, you use the word menstruator throughout the book. Talk to me why.
Well, I use both menstruator and women and girls to refer to people who menstruate. Not all women menstruate. Some people are before and some people are after menstruation. Some women never start menstruating. And there are people who don't identify as women and girls who also menstruate. So
right.
I decided not to make a choice, in fact, but to use the word menstruator where I thought it was appropriate. But it's a very gendered topic, menstruation. So people who don't identify as women and girls also suffer the injustices that are gendered, that really affect, that are based in patriarchy and views of women's bodies as less than other, evil, wrong.
Are you surprised, or maybe that's surprise is not the same word, the right word, that we're still at this point about menstruation where people still are shamed? And I'm talking about here in the United States. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about the rest of the world in a bit. Mm-hmm. But even here in the United States, there's incredible misinformation. Mm-hmm. There's still things that are, there's silence mostly.
Yeah.
And shame. Are you surprised that we're still there?
Not surprised.
That's sad.
That we're still there. You know, in 1974, I think, Gloria Steinem wrote this very funny essay called If Men Could Menstruate. And it could have been written yesterday. In that period of time, there were also books coming out saying, now we can talk about it and, you know, we're moving on. It's just a very old, baked-in part of patriarchal society that women's bodies are suspect, dangerous, wrong, and that women aren't exactly people. So it's going to take us a long time to undo that, to start talking about something that continues to be whispered about. I learned a lot. I was surprised by a lot by what the research that I did. But
what surprised you the most?
What surprised me the most?
That there were people.
Actually, what surprised me the most was a very happy fact, which is the amount of attention being paid to this topic, driven by young women, by young activists. Who are refusing to pretend that this isn't real, that it isn't an issue for them and their fellow menstruators, their sisters, in their communities and in communities around the world. And they are just not willing to put up with the silence anymore. And they are leading the charge. So that surprised me and delighted me.
On a lighter note, early on in the book, you list some of the euphemisms for mm-hmm. having your period. Mm-hmm. And I was... There were many that I did never heard of. I just want to pay attention. Aunt Flo makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Strawberry Week makes sense to me. The English Have Landed, which is a French euphemism, I don't understand.
Redcoats.
Oh, thank you.
And there's some very funny. There, you know, it's they're based in the culture, so they're from, you know, different places around the world. There's I can't remember them all, but there are some that just make you laugh, but you don't understand the context.
Well, that was one of them. I'm sitting there going like, well, this is a real old problem between France and England.
Yeah.
The thing that I took away from this book is here's a problem we actually can do something about positively.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
If only people put their attention and sort of a little bit of time into it.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is menstrual shame. One of the problems, and you bring this up in the book, is high school sex ed classes.
Yeah.
Why aren't boys taught about periods in their high school ed?
I think that's, again, embedded in this idea that it's embarrassing, it's shameful, it's something you whisper about, even if it's not, you know, it's health, okay. And I also want to say this is a middle school, junior high school and high school thing as well.
Right,
the thing
obviously.
I learned by talking to people who teach students and who are educators is that what would be most important is if everybody had the same classes around health. So that
the boys and the girls.
Yes, instead of splitting them up, you know, and there's this notion, oh, God, well, then the boys will giggle. So it's okay, so you giggle, and then you move on.
Right, right.
And if you start in fifth grade, as people suggest you do, when it's not really part of you and you learn about the circulatory system before it's part of your own group, before it's part of yourself or your sister, it's easier to keep it going. But the most telling thing, I talked to a man who teaches in Minneapolis, that when boys and girls are in the same room, they share a language about this then.
Right.
So they
right.
It's not just the, you know, the nuts and bolts of the biology, but they learn to speak about it. They hear teachers, hopefully male as well as female teachers, talking about this the way they talk about other things without, you know, without giggling, without, you know, acknowledging that, yes, this is a topic that not everybody talks about, but it's important that you know this. And this one teacher said, you know, it's about teaching empathy. So if you know that women are having their period, that the girl next to you is having her period, her sister, and she might have cramps, then you just sort of you understand that and you move on, you know, and you're sympathetic or you just acknowledge. But we don't have any models for this.
Right. You talk about a basic menstrual literacy. We don't have that.
No.
But even among doctors, you brought up a shocking example. You know, women who are having abnormal periods, like super high flow or really a lot of pain, doctors don't seem to react to that like it's an indication of general health.
It hasn't been. It hasn't been seen. It's just sort of like, well, some women have, you know, harder time than others, and, you know,
so that's
that, you know, use a heating pad. It hasn't been, again, it hasn't been taught in medical school as part of the primary intake that one takes when someone menstruates. When, you know, have you started your period? How is your period? Do you understand what's going on? Are you having a lot of pain? Let's talk about that. And that is also starting to change in medical schools, especially in large measure because so many women are not just becoming doctors, but are teaching and are learning that this is important stuff to pass on. It's being called the fifth vital sign for people who menstruate, you know, that you should be talking about, asking that question just as a basic health question. And yeah, no, it's still, we're all in this learning phase still. There is more conversation about this than ever before in history. Totally. We are definitely at some kind of an inflection point. I still get my Google alert on menstruation every day.
Yeah.
And which I did throughout, you know, doing research for this book. And California is about to mandate period products in all of its public schools.
You know, this is one of those things that I think if I thought about it, I would have been outraged, but I didn't even realize it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so in school, toilet paper is free. You don't pay for that.
Mm-hmm.
But menstrual products aren't in all schools for free?
Toilet paper are in all bathrooms for free.
Yeah.
This happened to me too when I started. I sort of smacked my forehead. It's like, of course. And when people sort of push back against this, it's like, well, do you carry toilet paper around with you? No, because it's not an amenity, it's a necessity. And because we haven't seen women as, you know, in the public sphere as human beings who, you know, with basic rights and needs, it just hasn't, and because we don't want to talk about it because, it's, you know, it's menstruation. It's only now becoming really a topic on the table for everybody to talk about. And there is starting to be less and less giggling and shame about it. And it's international, too, as you mentioned.
But there's a larger cost, both here in America and around the world. There's a cost to having your period.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Quite a number of people can't afford. For example, I think you quoted in the UK, the cost of a period in a year is about £500, which is a lot of mm-hmm. money. Mm-hmm. And people have to make hard decisions sometimes about whether to get period products or to put food on the table.
Exactly.
Talk about that.
Did
you realize that before you wrote the book? Because that's one of those things that I didn't realize until I read your book.
Well, you know, that didn't surprise me, but I had never thought about it.
Yeah, that's because exactly people, my reaction.
You know, people who are underprivileged in any number of ways, because of class, because of race, because of location, because of zip code, suffer everything more. And this is again one of those outrages that because of the accidents of birth, you may well find yourself stuck. The thing is, everybody who menstruates has one of those days where they forgot or they don't have enough.
Absolutely.
And they're stuck. But if this is part of your daily life and every month you don't know if you're going to have enough because your mom has to decide between can we afford another box of pads or, you know, food for everybody, milk, there's no choice. So you have to go with the milk. So do you go to school knowing you might bleed through? Do you go to school packing your underpants full of toilet paper?
Yep.
And of course you're not going to try out for the track team, right? And when you're taking a test, you're preoccupied and distracted by what's going to happen here. these are, you know, they compound all kinds of injustice. This menstrual injustice compounds other kinds of injustices as well.
Well, it's big business too. And that's one of the things your book brings up is there's a huge business about menstrual products.
Yes, a booming business, actually.
And there's a thing about period taxes. Talk about that.
Taxes sales taxes are levied by states and cities, not by the federal government. So in some states, there's a 9% sales tax on certain products, which are considered be not necessary, and in many states, and in many cities, period products and diapers, in some places, are taxed, and other things aren't. And you know, there's this hysterical and outrageous list of things that aren't taxed, like gun permits in Texas and Mardi Gras beads in Louisiana aren't taxed, but period products are. They were when I wrote the book. Things are changing fast.
I would hope so. I mean, that's obviously a basic product, a basic
it
health
is.
Product.
It's a basic need. It's not something you choose. It's like, oh, today I think I'll buy some, you know, some more pads, just to have them, just for fun.
This is like one of those things you sort of knew about in the periphery of your mind, but you hadn't paid attention to it. Then when you read it, it's shocking. It is depressing and scary. But like you said, hopefully it's changing now around the world. Mm-hmm. Outside of the United States, things are even more dire in many places. That people are talking about basic access to clean water, privacy, mm-hmm. healthcare, and of course, access to period products. And what do people do? I mean, people like we're saying in lower income in India, for instance, or anywhere in the world where there's a tremendous income disparity, what do women do?
Well, to some extent, they stay home. It's easier to manage at home. You're not going to get caught. You're not going to be embarrassed. And in some places, it impacts girls' education. And staying home from school one day a month or 3 days a month or more, depending on what's happening in your own body, can really put a huge dent in your education. Now, this is not the only reason girls drop out of school. There are a lot of other reasons as well, financial, and in many parts of the world, education, you have to pay for it, and if you're poor, you don't get it. But even if you can afford it and there are no products in the building, you are at a loss. And that also, and again, it's not just products, and I have to keep on reminding people it's about water, it's about safe bathrooms,
right.
It's about a way to dispose of products. It's, you know, all of that is wrapped up together. So when you tease out this one product thing, the lack of ways to manage, you expose all kinds of other inequities as well.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Anita Diamond, novelist, essayist, journalist, and we're talking about her latest book, Period, End of Sentence, A New Chapter in the Fight for Menstrual Justice. What was very shocking is the availability of these products to women who are incarcerated. Can you talk about that? That's depressing.
It is really shocking. I mean, there's a lot of evidence, and there have been studies done about not just the lack of products freely available to incarcerated menstruators, but the way that those products can be weaponized by guards and by the system itself, so that they might say, "Well, we do make products available, but you have to buy them in the commissary." And they're expensive, and it's a choice between calling home, because you have to pay for that too, and having menstrual products. And if you don't have enough and you bleed through your uniform, you can be punished for that, docked pay for that. And there are many, many, sadly, instances of guards demanding sexual favors in exchange for menstrual products. And there have been lawsuits filed all over the country. There is now a federal mandate that products be made freely available, but since the vast majority of women who are imprisoned are not in federal prisons, they're in state and local prisons, it's a state-by-state issue. And it is being litigated state-by-state, again, because there are more women in those legislatures and who are listening to the letters they're getting from incarcerated menstruators. So again, it's being addressed slowly, very slowly, but it's tricky because people will say, well, see, it's on the books. We do provide them, I mean, or they are made available. But what does that really mean inside a jail, inside a prison? So, yeah, but that's, again, it is in the news the way it never has been before. It continues to be raised in legislatures around the country. And, you know, it's an ongoing fight. And, you know, it's even worse for refugees in refugee camps.
Right,
you know,
and homeless.
And homeless people. And there are heroes around the country and around the world who are making a difference. There's a great story about Toronto. This one woman really kicked off a movement in her city because she was approached by some homeless woman asking for help, and she realized, well, what does she do if she's having her period, and decided to keep a purse with her that she would hand to somebody the next time she, that would include, you know, toothbrush and toilet paper and period products. And she started a nonprofit. She made contact with the city council, which then allocated money to put products in shelters and places like that. And now all the schools in Toronto also have period products in the schools. So this is one woman who started a movement in her own community to make a massive change. And it's in the news a lot in Toronto, so it becomes less and less of a secret. It becomes you know, a policy thing. So it can't happen fast enough, but we are in the middle of this kind of a sea change as well, in the middle of a lot of bad news about what's happening around women's bodies. This is an ongoing movement.
Well, there was the gentleman in India who invented a cheap way of producing pads.
Right, and one of the wonderful things about him is that he refused to copyright his invention.
So anybody could make it.
So anybody could make it, and people have indeed made and improved and made lighter ones and cheaper ones. And so these machines are now available in different places around the world. And those are disposable pads, which are, people are trying to make them biodegradable. But people are also sewing and handing out reusable cloth pads as well, is another alternative.
The environmental, and you address this in the book, you actually covered this, the environmental impact of some menstrual products is not good. It's
most
common waste that washes up on shore.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And our people seem to be, and you mentioned this in the book, developing environmentally more sound alternatives.
Yes, and that includes reusables, so there's less waste. Of course, you do need clean water as well, and running water for that. But menstrual cups, and which are worn internally and used over and over again, is one environmentally sustainable product. It's, however, they tend to be very expensive up front, and they are culturally suspect in some parts of the world. So there are lots of different attempts to come up with ways to manage menstrual waste that are better, that are less toxic, that are safe for women to use. So, and it's a business. It's a business. There are some companies, small companies, that for every product sold, they donate a product to somebody to an organization to help people who can't afford. So there's this kind of socially responsible manufacturing and commerce going on as well. So it's kind of everywhere if you know where to look.
Talk about the challenge of menstruation on the job.
That's
a huge problem. And there's the issue of menstrual leave, which is a contentious idea.
Yeah. So at work, like at school, all the bathrooms should have products in them. That's slowly starting to happen. And not just at work, in libraries and in bookstores and in all stores, it needs to happen. But at work, there's not a woman alive who hasn't gone to work and realized she had forgotten or she didn't have enough, and there is nothing there. And she feels like a 14-year-old again because just to stuff her underpants with toilet paper. In any event, so there's that. The notion of menstrual leave is very is controversial. The idea that a business would allow people who menstruate a day or 2 days off—that doesn't take away from their health, from their sick days, is controversial. Some people think that really will be a blow against advances made in women's employment in all kinds of organizations. And what I find really interesting about this is that that's a very age-related split. So younger women around the world have less of a problem with this notion of menstrual leave and feel less. They don't acknowledge the threat that might, you know, that people would be fired because of this.
Yeah.
And it's women over the age. I mean, we're talking about millennials and younger, who are they're much more comfortable with this notion than boomers and older people. So I think that's really interesting because I think it's this cultural shift where younger women are like, this is who we are. We need to be acknowledged. There are ways to do this. And there are companies, there are corporations that have started to institute menstrual leave. It's always a big news story when a large company does this. We'll know we've made a lot of progress when it stops being a news story, when a Fortune 500 company or a large company, as in India, has instituted this. All that does is acknowledge the fact that a good chunk of your workforce, their bodies are different, and we are not widgets. You know,
right.
we are human beings, and it's humane, it's human, it's kind. It needs to happen, I think. Again, it's very controversial, and it will take a long time for that.
We're completely out of time, Anita.
Okay.
Just talk about the need.
I could talk to you all day.
I know the need for menstrual education.
Yeah.
In your book, in 1983, when Sally Ride prepared to become the first American woman astronaut, the NASA engineers asked whether 100 tampons—that's one and two zeros—tampons would be enough for her 10-day trip into space.
Yeah,
that sort of points out what the problem is right there.
Right.
Anita, it's been a real pleasure. My guest tonight has been Anita Diamond. Novelist, essayist, journalist, and we've been talking about her latest book. You'll get a complete education from this book, and it's a fun book to read, an interesting book, and it'll also get you motivated. Period. End of sentence. A new chapter in the fight for menstrual justice. Anita, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
You're listening to WICM 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch.
Good night. That time of the month, well, I woke up early and I got